These are just like River Tree. I could let you do this for 10 minutes and you'd be totally happy doing that. So if you want to take a peek at it, here is that book that they were just mentioned. This is how you guys as a church are going to spend the next few months, working through what is the third book in this series, one of which you have already done. Now, in the past, when you went through The Good and Beautiful God, you did small groups, remember this, where you met and talked about the book as you made your way through it. You're not going to do that this time, but every one of the messages in this series, your pastor, Chris, has designed to correspond with the chapters in the book. So we do recommend that you get the book. He would like you to get the book and work your way through it as your speakers work their way through it for you. So today, it is my job, my friend, your pastor Chris told me, to get the series, oops, that's way too far ahead. Okay, yep. So ignore the screen for a minute. It is my job to start this, which means I get to start with the first chapter in the book. And the first chapter in the book focuses on one verse. Can you give me slide 2, Nate? That's the one right there. Perfect. This chapter has to do with this one verse. A verse that tells us a great deal about who we are as God's people, the church, and who you are within that. This is 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. But you, church, are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people possessed by God. Now, the key question, or at least one to consider to start, as we want to think about this verse this morning, is to whom was this verse first spoken? And my hint to you is, this is not the first time this verse appears in the Bible. If you go backward in your Bible, you find that the same phrases appear about Israel during its inception as a nation, as it gathered in Exodus 19 at the foot of Mount Sinai to receive from God the Ten Commandments and the law that would make them his chosen people, his light to the world during the Old Testament. And Peter lifts these ideas out of the Old Testament about God's people and says, now, to the church in the capital city of the Roman Empire, the city of Rome, this is about you. And every other church that would read it after the Roman church received it. And that means that it's no longer about Israel, but it's about the people who comprise that church. Rome was a big city 2,000 years ago when they received this letter. Could have been a group larger than this gathered as the first Christian church in the Roman city. It could have been 100 people, could have been 200 people. But here's what we know. That group of people was impossibly diverse. And I do use the word impossibly literally. We know from the other documents in the New Testament, you're talking about a church that included runaway slaves and the Roman soldiers whose job would have been in part to go find them and either kill them or return them to their masters. It included pious Jews who were steeped in Judaism in the Old Testament, and then a whole lot of people who weren't Jews. Your Bible's word for them is Gentiles, who had no clue what the Bible said and didn't care a hoot about any of the Jewish religious traditions and practices. And it is to this impossibly diverse group that Peter says, hold on to your identity. This is who you are. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, and a people possessed by God. Now, the truth is, your pastor, Chris, didn't ask my opinion. This verse would make a great series. Because what you'd do is you'd lift every one of those phrases out, and you'd spend a week talking about every one of those phrases. Sadly, we cannot do that. So what I'm going to do today is, instead of trying to talk to you about every one of these very rich and moving phrases, we're going to talk about one really well. We're going to talk about the underlying phrase that you, just like your predecessors in the Roman church, are, according to Peter, a royal priesthood. Now, in the great history of the Christian church, this idea has been called the priesthood of all believers. And one of the reasons that you are Protestants and not Catholics, going back to the European Reformation, is that idea right there. That's how instrumental it's been in the history of our faith movement. And the key here is, I want you to hear this phrase the way that Peter's readers, 2,000 years ago, as this motley crew of diverse people, would have heard this phrase or understood it. This is always a good practice, by the way, when you're reading the Bible or trying to understand the Bible for yourselves. Don't ask yourself, how do I as a 21st century American understand this verse or this idea? Start by asking yourself, how would the people who receive this in their culture have heard this and understood it? So, without question, the first impression that Peter's readers or hearers would have had about this idea is that it would have been unprecedented to them and therefore revolutionary. Because for every single person in the Roman church, regardless of their background, Jewish, non-Jewish, Roman, Greek, free, slave, rich, poor, man, woman, doesn't matter. Regardless of their cultural background, for every person in that church, a priest was a specialized class of person. And Peter says, it's all of you. All of you gathered together are priests. Not just a few, not just the best, not just the most deserving. All of you are priests. Without exception and equally. That means the poorest person and the richest person are equally priests. That means the most spiritually versed or mature and the least are capable of being priests equally. That means your age doesn't matter. That means your education doesn't matter, etc. One of the good things you guys do as a church that I really love is that you involve your kids and your teens in worship a lot. In fact, you allow them to lead. Do you know that's a very practical way that you live this out? Your children are priests, every bit as much as you are within this community of faith. This was driven home to me at my last church near Santa Fe, New Mexico. One of the people that God brought to us was a man named Gary. I got to know Gary through his wife, who was my banker. Gary was an alcoholic. And Gary had pretty much ruined his life by the time that I entered the picture. And on the way to rehab in Taos, New Mexico, in the back of a beat-up old church van, I was able to tell him about Jesus and the chance for transformation and renewal through the grace that God gives us through his Son. And after returning to our church from rehab, very early on, Gary pulled me aside after some Sunday service and said to me, you know, I don't feel like I fit in here. And I said, okay, Gary, tell me why. And he said, well, there are so many people who know so many more answers than I do. There are so many people here who frankly have their lives far more together than I do. And one of the things that I told him that day is, Gary, I get it. And I get it that there are even some people in church that would make you feel that way. That you're welcome here, but you are not equal. However, you, my brother, are a priest. And you are a priest equally with me and everybody else in this church who you think is better than you or knows better than you. and you have the capacity to function like a priest every bit as much as the rest of us do. And it changed his life to think that in his brokenness and his addiction and the mess that he had made of his family and his job and his finances, that somehow out of that, God could use that and the best of who he was and the gifts that he has that frankly he had laid aside because of his addiction for the sake of other people. And it changed him and it lifted him up. But the key here is it's everybody. You understand this phrase rightly and the extent of it and how unprecedented it is if you apply it to the people who make you uncomfortable. You guys as a church in February, you remember this? You did a series about the other, not fearing the other and embracing the other and loving the other. And you interviewed people like immigrants and whatnot. That's great. That's a huge step in the direction of embracing this idea. But you don't go far enough until you realize that this phrase applies to the people that make you personally the most uncomfortable in church. Because that's how a Jew and a Gentile would have felt 2,000 years ago. They didn't like each other. They didn't understand each other. They didn't even want to try. And that's how we have to view it, too. One of the most, you can ask your pastor, Chris, when he gets back from sabbatical about this. One of the very interesting email exchanges he and I had during that series that you guys were working through back in, I think it was February, right? Is he and I were identifying for each other and ourselves to one another, who are the people who make you the most uncomfortable? Not who makes other people around you uncomfortable. Who makes you uncomfortable? Because those are the people you have to see as priests equally as capable as you and equally able to minister and care. And I have to tell you, it was an eye-opening exchange of emails. No, I'm not going to tell you who was on my list. Relax, you weren't. So, four people in Peter's day, for starters, this would have been the primary or at least first reaction to this powerful idea of us all being priests. But the next thing that they would have thought is this. They would have thought, wow, in my culture, in my time, this is what makes priests unique. They don't exist for themselves. They exist for other people, on behalf of other people. Rome's this giant city, right? One of the largest cities in the known world at the time. And all over Rome would have been temples, worship centers of all kinds. They're familiar with what priests do, and they know what priests are supposed to be functioning like. And for them, they would have said, okay, I get it. By calling us priests, we, like these people in all the different religious centers in our city, we're supposed to be like this. We don't define ourselves by what's good for us or what we do for us, but what we do for other people. Let me specify. If you hear this the way that Peter's readers would have heard this, you'd have heard it this way. In the ancient world, imagine for me this scenario. You and I live 2,000 years ago in the city of Rome with the recipients of this letter. And then magically, one day, we wake up and all of the temples and worship centers and priests have been magically plucked out of the city, and they are no longer there. And all of a sudden, there's a glut of real estate. You can put hotels up, restaurants up, whatever, because all the temples are gone. How would that have impacted you as a hearer of this letter 2,000 years ago? You'd have felt like you lost God. That's how it would have impacted you. Because the priests in that day, regardless of religion, the priests of that day were the way that you found God. They were the way that you connected to God. In fact, a recipient of this letter would have told you, without the priests and what they do in your life, you can't find God or stay connected to him. Priests were that indispensable to your relationship with God. So when Peter calls these people in the church, and us priests. He's telling you, you and I and us together are an indispensable, indivisible way that people find God and stay connected with Him. And without you, we can't. And the people around you can't. So, which then leads me to wonder, okay, if this is true, and if this is how a first century reader or hearer of this would have heard this idea, for whom am I a priest? And I would ask you to consider, for whom are you a priest? Who in your life do you help find God? Who in your life do you help stay connected to God? And moreover, without your presence in their life, they can't. Because that's what this idea means. For whom are you a priest? Gathering here and singing a few songs and listening to a moderately adequate message does not make you a priest, does not make you function like a priest. In order for you to function like this, we're talking about something you do on Monday or Wednesday or Saturday morning. For whom are you a priest? Martin Luther would tell you, the great German reformer, one of the key people or key groups of people in your life for whom you are a priest are your kids. You are the way that they will define and understand who God is, not just now in their lives, but for the rest of their adulthood. For those of you who are parents. Who else? Every time I walk into Icons Coffee in Alger Heights and I see Andy Milley and Andy Miller seated over there doing his real estate stuff, Andy Miller is a priest in that setting. And whether or not he talks to everyone in the place, whoever it is that he interacts with, the barista, the person who makes his drink, the clients who come in and see him, the people who are inquiring about houses, he's a real estate broker, if in case you couldn't figure that out. All of those people have the chance to encounter not just Andy the real estate agent, but Andy the priest. Andy the person who through his persona and his countenance and his morals and his values and yes, his very words can say to them in so many words, I'm not sure where God is in your life. I'm not sure if you felt like you lost God 10 years ago. Today, right here, God is present. Today, you can find him because of me. That's what it means to be a priest. That's what it looks like for you and I to be priests. However, let me suggest you have to ask yourself the other, maybe more uncomfortable question, which is not just for whom are you a priest in your workplace, in your home, who is your priest? You can't be a priest for yourself, right? You get that? It's kind of like being your own doctor. Bad idea to self-diagnose your health issues. Uh-huh. Who's your priest? Who are the people in your life who help you find God and stay connected to Him? And without them, you don't very well. Now, I'll go ahead and say it. Regardless of how polite we smile at one another, a lot of American Christians think, well, I don't need people to play that indivisible a role in my life. And I'm sorry, Peter would disagree. No. Your relationship with God will always be stunted and half-grown if you don't have somebody playing the role of priest for you. For those of you who are in missional communities here, it should be there. But you should have people here within your faith community that you connect with in a committed way, in a regular way, and you know going in whether or not you say to one another the words that what you will do for each other is this: we will be each other's priests. And when you feel like you've lost God, that other person will help you find him. When you feel like God is absent or doesn't care, this other person will remind you that's not the case. One of my favorite expressions about what should go on in church between people is that we borrow each other's faith. Because there are times you have faith that I don't, and there are times I have it when you don't. And to be priests for one another, it looks like that. For whom are you a priest? When you leave here today, you're a priest by your holy calling. For whom will you be a priest? And who will you let be your priest? And to me, one of the coolest things to imagine about what it means to be priests, if you see it the way or hear it the way these hearers would have, you see, for them, in any ancient city, in their case, the city of Rome, these temples, these priests that lived among them, numbering in the hundreds, I'm sure, in the city of Rome, they went 24/7. You could be walking the streets at 3 in the morning, and these temples would be functioning. There would be sacrifices being made. You would hear the songs and the prayers echo around the neighborhoods from these temples. They never stopped. Whether or not anybody was paying attention, and whether or not anybody wanted them to, they just did. And that's what we're like too. What a powerful image of what church can be for each other and for our world, our neighbors out there. We will be each other's priests whether or not we ask each other to. We will be each other's priests whether or not we request one another to. We will seek each other's benefit. We will act on each other's behalf. We will pray for each other. We will give gifts of kindness and compassion and mercy and generosity to one another whether or not anybody asks. We just do it. It's who we are. It's our identity. You ever had the situation like I have, where I was teaching one Sunday at River Tree, and I mentioned in a sermon just kind of like this, I mentioned that I had been struggling with something in my life, and it had been going on for, frankly, several years. And I was very open and honest with them that finally I felt like in the last month or so, God had brought the right instruction and the right counselor and the right ideas. Everything synced up where I was finally turning a corner on this emotional weight that I had been carrying with me for years. And so after church, we're tearing down and, you know, putting the chairs away and everything. And somebody in our church, you don't know her, this lovely old person named Marge. She's 70 years old, and she's fantastic. She's one of my favorite people. I know I'm not supposed to say that, but I love Marge. Marge comes up to me afterward, and Marge says, you know, I just want you to know I've been praying for you. And she said, I've been praying for you for a long time. And she said, you know, I pray for you, just general stuff, but in the last few months, I've been praying for you about something that sounded a whole lot like what you talked about today. I didn't know it, but Marge was my priest. And Marge faithfully and devotedly prayed for me, her feeble pastor, when she could tell I was weak and struggling. And lo and behold, even though I didn't ask, she did. And I am sure that her faithful prayers were part of why I was finally able to turn that corner. This is what it means to be the church. It means for you to be priests and to do it for people, each other, and the world around you, whether or not you're asked. So here is your job description, and it's mine. And if you call yourself a follower of Jesus, then this is who you will be when you leave here today. You are not just a mom or a dad. You're not just a student or an employee. You're not just retired. You're a priest. And you can function like a priest for the people around you who desperately need it and whose lives will be less if you don't. And you should be committed to doing so for each other, for the people here in this community and those neighbors that you rub shoulder with every day, whether or not they ask. I love this quote from the great author and poet of the last century, D.H. Lawrence. And I suppose that it very aptly sums up what Peter was driving at when he called this impossibly diverse community of Christians 2,000 years ago to live out their high calling of being priests. D.H. Lawrence says, "I will always be a priest of love." That is what you have the chance to be, and I do, every day, every week, every year, together toward each other and toward the world who so desperately needs it. Now, interestingly, and Nate, you can come on up because I know you're going to play during communion. These are the verses that occur just before the one we looked at today.